morning, Great Britain, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, where we talk about music, film, TV and books in the manner of an enthusiastic but occasionally disappointed parent's evening. Adele is a bright girl but must apply herself and stop smoking. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we will be talking about new albums from Sleaford Mods and Stormzy, which sounds like an amazing collaboration, but in fact they just got albums out at the same time. Have Neck Slapper and Spacebar Pusher of Sleaford Mods in any way toned down their angry condemnations of Brexit Britain, bourgeois behaviour and the price of supermarket own brand lager? And will any of Sleaford Mod's tracks be playable on podcasts, let alone the radio? And, now that Stormzy is the UK number one album, what does this portend for the future of grime and the music of the youth? We'll also be looking at BBC4's documentary The Science of Pop, in which evolutionary biologist Professor Armand Leroy attempts to use statistical analysis and machine learning to discover whether there is an irreducible essence to the hit single. Is this the Philosopher's Stone of pop, or an affront to the very idea of creativity? Plus, we'll be hearing some of our guests' favourite songs of the moment, and a lot more besides. First, let's meet those actual guests. Andrew Mayle is a contributing editor to Mojo magazine and a writer for The Guardian, Sight and Sound and Sunday Times Culture. He's a former lecturer in film and a proud son of the Wirral, and he knows more about avant-garde Europop of the 60s and 70s than you can ever imagine. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fantastic, thank you.
What have you been chasing for Mojo lately?
There's a piece on The Last Poets in the current issue.
Yes.
And then I recently went over to New York to meet gurning Quasimodo of electropop in Future Islands.
Did you get the sense that New York City is a city under siege, resisting the outward tide of middle America?
I did actually get stopped at security though.
Really?
Yeah, because they said, oh, you know, I got me visa, and they said, oh, who are you coming over for? And I said, oh, Mojo magazine. And the guy just kind of went, you know, shook my head, and he goes, who else do you write for? And in a moment of idiotic panic, I said The Guardian. and he looked at me and he went, they're the ones who don't like our president, right?
And you say, nobody likes your president.
And I said, I just write the music bits.
We like your pop music.
And then he said it, because we're only joking. But it was scary. Yeah, that little moment I did think was, is this going to stop me getting in?
Well, you might as well be hung for a sheep's lamb and say, I also write for Black Panther Monthly.
And Marxism Today.
And Marxism Today, yes. Also with us is Mark Hooper, editor of the craft and artisan culture magazine Holland Corner, formerly of the Face Arena ID and Esquire. Mark now covers the busy world of handmade mead buckets, pocket knives made of jackalope antlers, and sustainable pelmets. Hello, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Yes.
What's you know, I jest about handmade stuff, but yeah. it is the happening thing, isn't it?
I mean, it's kind of, we sort of focus on making in general, so it can be. I mean, we had interview Peter Blake last issue, so it's kind of, you know, anybody who's creative. So it's not just a hand chiseled whatever's. I won't say more.
What's the most singular item you've covered lately? The most unusual?
Oh, what have we been doing? We always sort of go for eccentrics, really. So it's always kind of sort of mad person. The best, my favourite person ever was a woman who had a collection, the world's best collection of straw.
No way!
Items. Well, things made out of straw, not just straw.
Oh, just like, oh, yeah. This is from a field in Wiltshire. This is from a field in Sussex.
Exactly. To the layman, these piles of straw may look the same, yeah, but to the expert.
I wouldn't like to insure that. I mean, it's like gigantic fire hazard.
Exactly.
Blimey. Also with us today, as usual, operating a wooden mixing desk and recording Big Mouth onto original woolen audio tape, it is our producer, the Alan Lomax of podcasts, Matt Hall. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
Have you been getting into the artisan business? I mean, you're a long-time beard wearer. So
I'm a long-time beard wearer. I bake sourdough bread, and I have actually made my own pizza oven in the back garden.
You've made your own pizza oven?
But I built it out of a kind of essentially wattle and daub, yeah.
So I thought you were going to say you've made your own pizza. I mean, we've all done that.
You can buy the bases at Sainsbury's. They're really good, actually.
And that sauce.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the conversation's going into a fantastic segue here for Sleaford Mods. As promised, we're going to talk about two of the key albums this week. One is the new UK number one album, Gang Signs and Prayer, the debut by London grime MC Stormzy. Michael Omari from Thornton Heath has come up through the independent grime scene purely on freestyles, YouTube clips and guest performances to become one of Britain's biggest talents. His first album comes out on his independent hashtag Murky label and features MNEK, Wretch 32 and a load of baffling but exciting grime people. That's what the urban youth are listening to, but what about the miserable old white guys? Well, they are listening to rap as well, kind of. Sleaford Mods release what looks like their 10th album, if you can count them, this week. It's called English Tapas. Jason Williamson from the band says, Andrew, his partner in the band, walked into some random pub and saw English tapas scrawled on the menu board underneath this beautiful coupling of words were its components. Half a scotch egg, a cup of chips, pickle and a mini pork pie. It says everything about this fucking place. It's comedy, it's make-do, it's ignorance and above all, it's shit. Before we talk about English tapas, let's have a listen. This track is I Feel So Wrong. Actual singing alert. That was I Feel So Wrong by Sleaford Mods from English Tapas. Now, Andrew Mayle, you had a bit of a Proustian rush there, didn't you?
He sounds like Vice Subversa from the Poison Girls.
That's probably... They should stick that on the sticker on the front, yeah. Shouldn't they?
But no, but it's kind of... And you hear that and you think, that's exactly what it's reminding me of. That was sort of, you know, playing with my head, that kind of weird world of kind of regional, small-time, post-punk Britain in the early 80s. You know, that kind of very cheap, very make-do, very angry, very regional. And you kind of, you know, I was it always used to bother me when I kind of listened to Sleaford Mods, because who's it remind me of? And that's it. And as soon as that kind of that voice came in, it kind of all sort of, a foul Proustian rush.
Do you think things were better when a train to London took like 6 hours instead of two then? Because it just preserved that world.
One of my friends, when I was at North Staff's Polly, which is very kind of vice versa of the Poison Girls, very Sleaford Mods. We had a mate, Mick the Old Punk, he was called. He was 26. Right, and Mick the Old Punk basically said kind of he would time train journeys by how many cans you got. So it was like kind of whether it was a four canner or a six canner, you know, and that was kind of how you measured time in the 80s.
So Darwin measured his. This is true. It sounds like a joke. It said Darwin measured how difficult a scientific theory was by who would go on a walk and knock a stone over it each time he'd done a lap of his garden.
Not a can of lager.
Probably had a lager on top of a pile of Darwin.
By using my punk Darwin measurements.
Exactly. Anyway, back to the subject. Andrew Mayle, what do you make of them in general? And what do you make of this record?
In general, I like them. I like that kind of sort of fractured... Teretic surrealism, did you call it? And you kind of, you know, news broadcasts from somewhere sort of static and horrible. It's weird, kind of, because I follow them on Twitter, and what was odd was they retweeted something that I'd said, and all the followers that got back, the people who follow them, it was loads of kind of problematic UK flag icons. And it was funny listening to this, not knowing where the authorial voice is coming from. It could be misconstrued and sound like a lot of Brexit moaning. But when they're good, so there's a track called Drayton Manored, which is absolutely fantastic about that modern alcoholic lost weekend. You know, put my phone in tar. A trip to Spa is like a trip to Mars. When they sort of tap into that six-pint surrealism of fractured Britain, I think they're brilliant. But I think there's occasional sort of moments on this, you know, when you've got the farting sound effects on Army Nights and when it just kind of sounds like the League of Bald-Headed Men griping about, you know, how things are crap. It can become a bit wearying and a bit problematic. Where is this voice of complaint coming from? Yeah. Who is saying it? And what do they what do they think?
This album has got, there's a track on it called Just Like We Do, which sounds to me like it is Jason Williamson having a right pop at Noel Gallagher.
Yeah.
You can see where that's coming from. That's actually a bit different from what they've done before. He's actually kind of standing up and going, this is me, and I don't like you.
Yeah.
And
Noel Gallagher, Noel Gallagher famously dismissed him as standing like the brown bottle out of Viz comic, which I don't think is a diss or a...
No, absolutely not.
Mark, what was your take on
Yes, actually, I was going to pick up on Just Like We Do as well, because I thought, you know, they've reached this kind of difficult 10th album stage where it's always that album, you know, they're in danger of repeating themselves, which they do. I think there's real kind of, there's a lot of kind of really surprising depth in this album, which I wasn't expecting, the singing. A few occasions, it sounds just like Paul Weller, and really, particularly late Paul Weller, where he's getting into quite avant-garde, sort of, you know, being a bit more experimental.
Can I make a vote for the track that you said like sounded like Vice Versa? I think really reminded me of Leiden in kind of Death Disco.
And also a bit of polystyrene in there as well. Yeah. You know, so,
but it's singing, which is different. It's moving on, isn't it?
Definitely.
I just thought it was quite funny that, you know, that's going to really annoy Paul Weller fans, yeah, because he's, you know, people always talk about, like, you're the great white soul voice, and then in that song, yeah, says, I'm just a pisshead knocking out half-cut ideas. So, like,
I don't know. I reckon there is a massive Venn diagram crossover between Weller fans,
yeah, who, oh, absolutely,
are grumpy old, yeah, white blokes.
Well, so. Jason Williamson is a Weller fan. He is a, yeah, disgruntled Weller, yeah, and Noel, yeah, fan. Yeah. And that's where the pain comes out from. And I think the, yeah, good thing about that voice is it fits, it suits those lyrics. It has, yeah, that kind of pain in it, yeah, that kind of feels kind of necessary for, yeah, a Sleaford Mods lyric.
There must have been a 5-minute window when people didn't really know what they sounded like, that loads of, like, old Lambrettas fans were buying this record, yeah, getting it home and being horrified, yeah, by what they purchased.
I was talking about America. There's a hilarious thing I saw on Twitter or Instagram or something, and there was a, in an American sort of indie record shop, and they, you know, and they have those kind of reviews where they basically stick the whole front of the album with it, what they think about, sort of, you know, staff reviews, and it's brilliant. It's just like, I have no idea what these guys are talking about. I'm sure a lot of it is very rude, but it's amazing. It's like the idea of listeners is not even having a clue. Like, there's no social references. They don't even know what half the words are and stuff, but they still, like, really kind of, yeah, liked it musically.
It's,
yeah,
kind of, can I make a point about the music? Because I think that it's, there's a real kind of sense of advancement in the, yeah, actual music, which, yeah, is the cliche about it is Mr. Spacebar.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, things like, I think it's a track, Time Sands,
yeah,
is,
yeah,
actually much kind of slower, yeah, and dare one say funky.
Yeah.
And, well, and the fact that Mr. Spacebar Pusher, yeah, does actually release ambient stuff under his own kind of solo label, I think is, that's kind of, there's a bit of cross pollination going on there, which is,
I think that's, you know, it's not just a load of, like, Brexit moaning, and I think, I mean, particularly the track that we played, the last track, I Feel So Wrong, is, yeah, like, that's the window into the actual soul of the, yeah, totally confused,
yeah,
and the dislocated middle aged bloke. I mean, there's a fantastic line, like, the future is a flag pissed on and a king sized, yeah, bag of quavers. Well, this is not, you know, I sort of feel like they, you know, there's a potential for them to fall into the kind of the Alf Garnett trap, yeah, of what they're, you know, what they're satirizing and what they're, yeah, talking about. Yeah. People are out there going, yeah, that's you. Yeah. You're telling it like it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there an element, though? I mean, because they're very much rock critic rock, aren't they? People, like, always love them.
Yeah.
And they're not really kind of making inroads into the Adele market or anything like that. But, I mean, is there an element of class tourism there a little bit? You know, the people like us who live sort of in the metropolitan media elites can go, oh, yeah, that's like how it's lived. Well said, Sleaford Mods.
But I don't know. That's the thing I was saying. I don't know if it is, you know, kind of, there is a particular authorial surrealism to it, which kind of it's Jason Williamson's fractured worldview. So it's kind, yeah, of, it's not, you know, it's not a realist picture. It's not a documentary. It is like kind of there's an authorial madness to it, which I, yeah, think is one of the great things, you know, that kind of, it's his damaged brain that's looking yeah, at this world. Yeah. But I think, you know, and I think sometimes that works against it, but I think for the most part, unless it works in its favour, you know.
So the Sleaford Mods have actually pulled it off. Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Let's talk about what the young people are listening to then. We're going to have a look at Stormzy's new album, Gang Signs and Prayer. To get you in the mood, here is Big For Your Boots. In your town to
You're getting way too big for your boots.
Stormzy there with Big For Your Boots from Gang Signs and Prayer. Mark Hooper, you're saying this is the sound of Nottingham against some Alan. He's not actually
he's
from
got,
Nottingham.
He's got his brilliant bell.
Boots.
The boots. Yeah. Yeah, I think the first thing to say, like Sleaford, suddenly he's like, he's a singer. He actually makes a point, because a few moments in the album, you know, there's a little skit and there's a bit, he sings, I thought that Stormzy couldn't sing, sort of taking the mickey out of himself. But it's really interesting. He's, you know, he's obviously like the number one grime star. But what I found really interesting, I really like the slightly more aggressive urban sort of sound of about half of this album, but the other half is really quite smooth, you know, something rhyme with New Jack Swing and a bit of kind of Prince in the sort of 90s.
There's a slow jam or two.
Yeah, and there's a little skit where they basically have an FM radio DJ come on and go, oh, that was a smooth sound of Storm. I really love the fact that he's trying to expand and break out, and he said on quite a few times, you know, he wants to be treated in the same way that people talk about Adele. And he name checks her on the album, and it's quite interesting that he's, you know, he's putting his money where his mouth is. And I don't particularly like all of the slower, smoother stuff on the album, but it's really impressive that he's doing that and singing. And there's a sort of gospel track which is split sort of part one and part two. And the first part is great; it's like a sort of Hammond organ and really fits in really well with the album. And the second one, it's like a full-on album, a full-on gospel track, and it doesn't quite sit very well.
Yeah.
And it's almost like this sort of schizophrenic thing where he's talking about his past and his, you know, life of crime and bad boys and stuff, and then he shows a sensitive side, and it's, you know, it's really great to show, you know, this is a fully fleshed person. It's not just a sort of character.
What I found impressive about it was that it is massively musically varied, and there's loads of rave on it, and there's loads of stuff, you know, everything from proper electronic weirdness to out and out, just, you know, for the crowds, you know, full on aggressive rhyming kind of thing. But it's like, it's really ambitious. And it doesn't sound like somebody templating from some, you know, you wouldn't say this has been drawn directly from, you know, Jay-Z or, you know, Beyonce or, you know, back to any time in the past the hip hop you want to listen to. It sounds entirely British and entirely like him, which I thought was really refreshing.
You know, grime is mainstream now. I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, you shouldn't be surprised that it sounds like a big album because, you know, grime's big. It's not some little niche scene anymore.
Yeah. Andrew, what did you make of it?
I totally agree with you. I also like the fact that you get a real sense of person and place in it. You know, it's for method reasons, actually listened to it at a cafe in Croydon, you know.
So. Yeah.
But it was, you know, you still get a very, you know, the thing we were saying about Jason Williamson, like, who is this person who is spewing out all this stuff? Whereas I think with Stormzy, you get a very strong sense of this person in terms of his strengths, his weaknesses, his humour, it's funny, you know, but, you know, it's also kind of about the minutiae of his life as well still. Mm. And the one thing I would say with it, it's kind of, for extra research, I went back and listened to the Skepta album and the Kano album, and kind of it's a very different sound. It's much more sort of bright and high end. It kind of lacks that kind of, you know, deeper sort of bass sound, and kind of that felt a bit odd to me at times. And also, I sort of agree with Mark. I think maybe there's one too many sort of slow jams on there. My only worry would be kind of losing a bit of that edge and a bit of that weight, and having a bit too many kind of, you know, philosophical slow jams on it, that I wouldn't want it to be the grime equivalent of Goldie's Timeless, you know. I wouldn't want it, you know, suddenly for it to get, you know, us to get sort of intelligent grime, you know, sort of a kind of, you know, and that would be my only concern about it. But that sense in which I get, you know, you get this picture of a very sort of, you know, human and sometimes quite, you know, sort of damaged, you know, you can tell that he's been through some rough stuff. And that full portrait of a person on it, I thought I was really impressed with it.
Matt, how does he shape up as a rapper? Because you know your rap stuff inside out.
I do, but I've always had a slight issue or problem with, I'm sure there are grime kind of Jesuits who can distinguish between, tell me where grime finishes, MCing finishes, and hip-hop rapping starts. And he seems to be very much kind of on that junction. Because some of his stuff sounds a lot. He gives a shout out to a guy called Giggs, who has been, everyone thought was going to break through a couple of years ago, who's got a much more kind of slower and monotonous kind of rap style, and would definitely say that he's a rapper from London. But he's got flow, as I believe people say. but there are, I kind of do like that juxtaposition between, he's almost like showing he can do it at a more kind of standard hip-hop beat and structure 16 bars and then go to a chorus and do that kind of hip-hop thing. And then he can also do that almost stream of consciousness grime thing of just picking on a supposed kind of competitor or whatever and just going on and on and on and on and on at them until he kind of runs out of things to say, which is entertaining, but isn't necessarily kind of top 40 fodder. I think it's, you know, my daughter is really into this album, 12 years old white girl living in the kind of Midlands, and so I think that's quite interesting how they've managed to cross put this himself and his work and this whole kind of package, don't forget, without a label, into that kind of space. I think that's kind of, you know, almost what he does as a musician, which is really good, is kind of less important than what he represents for the kind of industry.
Well, I mean, black British artists would often get burdened with the idea of having to be, you know, representatives of modern Britain today, like poor old Miss Dynamite got absorbed by New Labour. And this is kind of, and it kind of, you know, it sort of sets their career off in a terrible direction. I think it's quite good that there's no Gordon Browns around anymore to pretend that they're really into the Stormzy album.
Yeah, I bet you Jeremy Hunt is going to...
Yeah, really into Stormzy.
Well, I think the good thing is there's no one person for it to sit on the shoulders of, because, you know, we were talking about, you know, the Skepta album, the Kano album, so it's like, you know, you haven't got everyone sort of flocking to this kind of one representative. You've actually, what you've actually got is a great, you know, kind of not wanting to sound like a Labour politician, but you've got a great show of British talent, you know, and kind of there's no one who's having to take all that kind of cultural weight. You're actually just kind of going, oh, I prefer him, or I prefer this, I prefer that, which is exactly what should be going on, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on with some other music. Every week we ask our guests to come in with a tune each, something that they love right now. It can be old, it can be new, it's anything, as long as it is their editor's recommendation. Andrew Mayle, what have you brought to show the class?
I've brought a track by, it's not new, well, it kind of is. It's a track by a guy called Gene Clark, who used to be in The Byrds, and died far too young from living far too high. And it's basically this guy called, an archivist called John Delgatto, who's probably the world's number one Byrds fan. He's kind of knew that sort of Gene's sort of drunken peripatetic life meant that studios had all these kind of lost tapes, you know, kind of that even he'd forgotten about. He'd record full albums and then just kind of walk away from them and things like that. So he's spent about the last 10 years tracking down all these lost tapes, and they've just come out on a CD called The Lost Studio Sessions 1964 to 1982. And this one, the track I've chosen, which is Roll in My Sweet Baby's Arms, particularly painful because his supposed pal Terry Melcher took a bunch of Gene's tracks for his own 1974 solo album and taped over them, and taped over his own voice over Gene's voice, and then put them onto his album. So John Delgatto has actually found the original Gene Clark vocals, the vocal versions, and there's two tracks on this CD. All of the CD is great, but this one's is particularly sort of lovely because it has that kind of deep Gene Clark melancholy to it. And you've got extra melancholy because the realization that this track was just, you know, taped over by a friend. I'm having that.
Yeah, taped over by a friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here we go. This is the original version of, I suppose it's like that when that woman painted over Jesus' face.
It's exactly like that.
So this is Roll in My Sweet Baby's Arms by Gene Clark.
Where were you last
Roll in My Sweet Baby's Arms by Gene Clark, as chosen by our guest Andrew Mayle. Now, in the most grindingly artificial link ever, could a computer ever make a sound like that? No, of course it couldn't. Well, this week, a BBC documentary attempted to work out whether data technology can find an irreducible core of what makes a song a hit. In The Science of Pop, Professor Armand Leroy, an evolutionary biologist, brought together a team of data scientists to analyse the characteristics of 60 years of hit music via machine learning. The plan was to use this information to advise Trevor Horn on how to turn a song by an unknown artist into a hit. Did it work? And is it worth watching? Because it's still on the iPlayer. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, Any Excuse, produced by Trevor Horn, who appears in the show, in the glory of his purple period. This is Yes, an Owner of a Lonely Heart. Yes, an Owner of a Lonely Heart, produced by Trevor Horn, who appears in rather bemused form on BBC4's The Science of Pop. Matt Hall, you were moaning about that record then. It's the art of noise. You can't complain about it.
I think you can, and I just have.
I think that's no, it's on the contract we signed before we came in here. The art of noise, you can't complain about it.
So, we're going to talk about BBC4's The Science of Pop, which asks, can a machine evaluate songs better than humans, and can it give a formula for hit songs? Andrew Mayle, this is a red rag to the likes of us, isn't it? The idea that you just feed a load of stuff into a burping machine and it'll tell us what's what.
Well, the problem I had with it, as a scientist, he doesn't define his terms. You know, he's all over the shop. Because initially he's talking about the idea of, you know, looking at the, you know, the great mutation that changes the direction of pop. So he talks about Autobahn. But of course, he talks about this as a mutation with no precedent. So he doesn't play, you know, Noi or Dino by Harmonia or the Beach Boys,
well,
you know,
which
fed into Autobahn.
His whole thing at the start was that I know nothing about pop music. But and then you play the start of Autobahn and it's quite obviously a doo-wop record.
You know? It's kind of like, but he doesn't define his terms, but he also doesn't remain on a fixed point of kind of authority. So he kind of begins from this skeptical position. Then he says, I don't know anything about pop. Then he offers up all these kind of pop maxims, you know, yeah. Which seemed very, I mean, if a record producer came in and started talking about fruit fly mutation, the way he talks about pop, he'd be fuming. And, you know, because that's his speciality. And you know, it's kind of there. I felt that there was a good program in there. If he'd started from a position of ignorance, as a scientist should, if he defined his terms as a scientist should, and proceeded through on a parallel path as a scientist should, but he doesn't do any of those things. Yeah. And I kind of suspected the hand of kind of, you know, meddling producers saying, can we have you do this? Mm. Or can we have this bit in? And could you say that?
Yeah.
Because, well, it did feel a bit of a mess to me.
The core of it was that they fed the music, basically 60s of the charts, into a machine learning apparatus to crunch all the characteristics and measure the rate of change of music to try and pinpoint these revolutions. And he came up with three kind of inflection points: British rock and roll in the 60s, the arrival of disco in 76-77, and then the growth of electronic music. And I'm behind all of that. That's absolutely valid.
The network that he created was great.
Yeah,
that central sort of,
you see, an amazing web of blobs like that.
Wonderful.
It's the kind of thing you want to have a look at on a gigantic Ortega record sleeve. And
it was like a piece of Jeremy Deller art, wasn't it?
It was like a piece of Jeremy Deller art. Yeah.
My notes at the end of this program just had three words on it: Pound Shop Brian Eno. And I kind of get the feeling that the producers really wanted Brian Eno to do this, and Brian Eno could have carried this off. And the other thing I'd like to say is that they've been trailing this on BBC Four for donkeys. I've got a feeling the trail was delivered and everyone got very excited, and then when they saw the final finished programme, it was shifted to midweek.
Yeah. You know, it was very brass-eye at times. That was one of the reasons why it was enjoyable. You know, when he says, house, techno, not to mention Eurofunk, speedcore and cybergrind. I have no idea what I just said.
Cybergrind? What is cybergrind?
I really don't know what cybergrind is.
Great. Maybe you take a Clarky Cat and, you know, tell you to zoom out to it. Mark Hooper, you're a handmade man. I keep banging on about this. Was this an affront to your idea?
Weirdly, musically, I'm very, you know, my tastes are very electronic, but... Yeah, I think if you're going to scientifically go through all the data and pinpoint everything that annoys me about music documentaries, this would be
exactly just the average.
Sort of, I mean, hold that thought. I'm writing a pitch even as we speak.
I think, as everyone said, that, you know, for a start, the methodology was all wrong.
What did we think about Paul Trevor Horn's involvement and the new artist? What's her name? Nicky Jamil. It was like, we were told that getting hits were involved in an element of risk, and found a very, very
It was so crushing at point. Like you said, like Trevor Horn just looked slightly baffled the whole time. And I loved at the beginning, why are you doing this? Or so he sort of basically said, you know, what's your expertise? And he said, I study worms.
Yeah.
You know, for me, pop is all about 20 hours breaking the rules, and, you know, through instinct and chutzpah, and it's not about academics who start off admitting they don't like music. And there were points when they were making the song and they'd hit on some little, you know, she'd do a few little ad libs and they're like, oh, that's beautiful, that's brilliant. And then that's what makes a hit, that moment which you're not expecting. And they just sort of gloss over that. And a few moments he sort of said, oh, of course, you know, we don't take into account charisma and, you know, all the stuff that makes pop great. You know, appealing to, you know, he talks a lot about appealing to prepubescent girls, but he didn't talk about sex appeal. And it just didn't. Yeah,
there was a very interesting bit where Trevor Horn lists the things you need to get a hit record. Yeah. And he says you need great material, you need a 2-octave voice, which I'd never thought about before, but it's probably true. You need personal charm and charisma, you need to be mentally and physically strong, and you have to want it. And only one of those things is even remotely susceptible to data.
Yeah.
And to me, this is kind of just another example of how we think the entire world... It's the Uberization of everything, the Facebookization of it, that everything can be reduced to data. You know, this is going to sound like Adam Curtis, isn't it? They started to dissolve everything into numbers, and then they found that they were wrong. You know, it was a little kind of like a tiny version of that kind of thing.
But the thing that I think, you know, infuriates me the most, he goes on about science, but then he allows his snobbery to come into it as well. You know, he ultimately is a pop, you know, is a snob about the thing that he is researching. So it's not even just about data in the end. He has all these kind of supposedly amusing withering asides about various points in the history of pop.
I was really annoyed when he said the Beatles are just writing songs for prepubescent girls. And I'm like, I mean, foolish thing to say.
But kind of on every level, that is a foolish thing to say. You know, because it ignores the importance of prepubescent girls in the history of pop music.
And he also started off, as we were saying, like, you know, there was no, he didn't sort of put things into context. So I'd made the exact same point about Kraftwerk and the Beach Boys not acknowledging where those influences came from, the fact they were trying to do the opposite of soul music. But also, he's sort of set the whole thing up by saying we're starting with a revolution in data and talked about the Beatles. But that ignores the fact that there were all these million-selling, amazing 50s pop singers. Why is the 60s more important than the 50s? Yeah. You know, it just didn't... It just, everything
you could argue,
random,
actually, that today's pop has got a lot more in common with the late 1950s than it has with the mid-1960s. Yes. I'm going to pitch a recipe cooking show, and the idea is you're going to cook a souffle with no recipe or ingredients. And we're going to get this guy to do the data science, and that's going to get us where we need to be on this one.
His hubris at the end was welcome. You know, there was a certain kind of, you know, humility and failure at the end that was kind of quite gratifying. But other than that...
Well, if you're still interested, I mean, I think it is worth a watch, if only you want to grind your teeth a little bit. The BBC's The Science of Pop is still available on iPlayer. So let's have some more tunes. Mark Hooper, let's have your editor's recommendation. What have you brought in?
Yeah, well, quite aptly, The Mystery of Pop.
Great.
By Temples. It's for their new album, Volcano. Obviously seemed quite appropriate given what we were talking about. But... this is what a band I've got completely wrong, actually. I think probably just seeing pictures of them, I kind of assumed they were sort of retro, sort of psychedelic furs, sort of throwback. There's a lot of kind of bands like that at the moment. I think probably just one of their haircuts kind of gave me the wrong impression. I just wasn't interested. I listened to it and it's amazing. It's actually, you know, it's really exciting. It's quite sort of, first thing I thought was like Baroque pop, like, you know, Prince went into that sort of Paisley period where he was, you know, sort of
harpsichord.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it really reminds you a lot of those new Aussie bands, like, well, new, so, you know, last 10 years, Tame Impala and Empire of the Sun. It's got that kind of sort of psychedelic poppy grandeur about it. And I know Jeff Barrett, who runs Heavenly Records, sort of identified them and Toy, another one of his bands, as the sort of bands which could sort of create the spark and gave him his mojo back. And I kind of finally realised, because now I've actually listened to it properly. And I thought it was an absolutely amazing album. And it's almost like sort of opened a whole new area. You know, when you sort of think, I know what I like about music now and I don't really want to listen to anything else. And I sort of dismissed all these bands. Now I think, oh, there's some more to discover.
Try something new. So yeah, haircuts, that's another data point that wasn't present in BBC Science of Pop. This is Temples and The Mystery of Pop. Of Pop by Temples, as chosen by Mark Hooper. Okay, close listeners may know that Big Mouth is very much indebted to the fantastic podcast, The Slate Political Gabfest, which is all about US politics, and it has a room full of people talking about three big stories in the week. Hem hem, sounds familiar. Last week, they did a great bit on a list of boring conversation topics that the presenter David Plotzer's parents had written back in 1992. These included home insurance, reviews of books and movies you haven't seen, cholesterol, recycling, all television programmes, and my favourite, how much better their earlier albums were. So I thought we'd do our own list of boring conversation topics that keep coming up that bores talk about. Mark Hooper, what have you got?
Why there's no plots in movies anymore, which really gets, like, you know, for a start, you don't necessarily need a plot, you know, the way that you think. But then on the sort of counter to that, people always talk about why TV allows for better character development. And it really, because especially the way American TV is set up, yeah, it does for the first series, and then they're not sure if they're going to get recommissioned, so they kind of tread water for a bit. And talk about plot, they have the most circular plots. And it's like people have suddenly just started saying, you know, however many seasons of Walking Dead, and it's not very good, is it? Of course it isn't. I stopped watching it after the second season.
Character development tends to mean people standing alone smoking a fag for a while, doesn't it?
Talking about their daughter or something.
Yeah. Andrew Mayle, what have you got on the...
Kind of related, the golden age of television is kind of is related to that, isn't it? You know, kind of how...
What,
you know,
like, just like the, it is now?
The con, the, yeah, the, no, yes, that this, we are living through the golden age of television. Right, yeah. And kind of, but it's kind of related to what Mark was saying about this kind of ridiculous idea that kind of, you know, movies are somehow worthless now and TV is where all the intelligent people go to watch these long-form dramas. Whereas I actually kind of think, you know, I was watching an old episode of Columbo recently and marvelling at how good it was on the level of, you know, sort of character and performance, and just thinking kind of, these people are basically saying that TV was rubbish then, but it's somehow marvellous now. And kind of, it's It's gloriously clueless in a way.
I was we talked about the OA on Netflix on a few podcasts ago, and I was highly amused to see a friend of the podcast, Dorian Lindsay, on Facebook raging about getting to the end of the OA and saying, there was a load of bollocks, nothing happened, pointless. What else did you got?
Quite interestingly, one of the things I had down was deeply serious matters of politics, race, gender, and mental health.
Oh, God.
Because it is like kind of that because of the nature of discourse now, because so much of it takes place online, these things that are incredibly important, they're not boring, they are very serious, but we are bored of them. You know, kind of we think, oh, God, they're going on about that. I'm not going to say specifics here, but, you know, you'll go, oh, God, they're going on about that again. Mm. And it's not because of the subject matter in a way. It's because of how we discuss them and how often we discuss them online and how by the time we finally do get to talk about them face to face, we are already wearied of them because of Facebook and because of Twitter.
But maybe if people like us have proper jobs, like driving lorries or teaching kids, we wouldn't be on Facebook all day long having arguments about what's problematic. And
that's true, but maybe if we had proper jobs, we wouldn't be having these boring conversations
either. Matt Hall, what are your boring topics of conversation?
Well, I think that as Andrew and Mark have pointed out, the problem is that the internet has just enabled everybody to find one boring topic of conversation, one Mr. Angry kind of thing that they really dislike, and make a whole kind of section out of it. There's one of my kind of websites that I regularly go to is Hip Hop Golden Age, where they just basically talk about how things were much better back in the Bronx in the kind of early late 80s. And I'm in fact currently deciding whether or not to buy for my summer outfit is basically going to be one of their t-shirts, which is just contains the line, "Why are you making these whack rappers famous?" Which I think is kind of that's the kind of question that I intend to be asking lots of people this year.
Excellent. Well, one of my boring topics dovetails with that definitely. It's like, what's Real House and what's not Real House? This drives me insane. People getting all worked up about, you know, Show Me Love because it's not Real House, because it had the absolute effrontery to become a hit, and it's not 14 minutes long and mixed by Masterwork, not Real House. And which actually, you know, dovetails with the other, you know, another one of the great boring topics of conversation, real music versus manufactured music.
The worst.
What's real and what's sincere and what's real? Well, I'm sorry, all of your Motown records that you love were produced on a production line with the same band and the same techniques, and the singers were frog marched in and told to do their stuff and then bugger off back to the typing pool. That's an immensely... The other one...
Marvin Gaye was the worst typist, I imagine. Back to the typing pool, Marvin.
Yeah, there's some powder all over the typewriter, Marvin. What's going on? So, we've now just basically killed off the entire future agenda for this podcast. I'm not going to talk about any of them. Okay, so we're coming up to the end of the show, and that means it is time for some closing time chatter where our guests share the stories or the ideas or the features that have excited them or driven them up the wall this week. Andrew Mayle, your closing time chatter.
I may have mentioned Twitter once or twice earlier in the programme, and it is something Twitter related. It's a Twitter feed called Pass Postcard, and it's an incredibly simple idea. It's the front of an old postcard accompanied by a sort of gnomic extract from the text, beautifully edited. And they're kind of like, I like them because they're like fragments of our holidaying past that kind of tap into kind of what I think is very real Britain, a sort of banal lyricism of the British condition, you know, which is kind of a mix of sort of, you know, one, nostalgia, profound melancholy, stoic humour, and inexplicable dread. And they kind of... exactly. And they felt that, you know, during this kind of miserable sort of 12 months or so, they felt like a sort of survival text for post-Brexit Britain, because they kind of, they tap into sort of what I think is kind of, you know, a very funny and very real bleak idea of Britain without this idea of sort of, you know, false hope or sort of ludicrous ideas of nationalism. And just, I was just looking at, I mean, kind of thought, well, I thought I'd better have, you know, a couple of... recent favorite ones, but every day is so good. This is basically, I think it's from yesterday, one that was the obviously I can't tell you what the pictures are, but they're all kind of, you know, picturesque views of England, and one was, "I've been to the Cumberland Pencil Museum alone." And "I am looking forward to being home again after this hell."
I'm sure I've written a postcard saying "I am looking forward to being home after this hell" at some point. Mark Hooper, what have you got on your closing time chatter?
A sort of obscure writer called B.S. Johnson, who, relatively obscure, committed suicide actually, sadly, in 1973. So he wrote mainly in sort of 60s and early 70s. And I actually, sort of full disclosure, I co-edit a literary journal about him, which I find really fun because I'm sort of moonlighting in this kind of world of peer review papers and stuff. And I'm just like,
can't we just, that's fine, let's just edit it. No, we've got to get four people to give their comment on it and stuff. It takes about a year to get each one out, but we've just released a new one, and I should say there's the website bsjohnson.org, so you can sort of order it online from there.
Where should people start on BS Johnson then? Early stuff, yeah?
Well, actually, well, no, there's a book, it sounds dodgy, but it's not, Christy Mowry's own Double Entry, which is about double entry bookkeeping, which is, you know, like profit and loss. And it's basically, this guy has a moral profit and loss, so he's basically a terrorist, and he's grossly over exaggerates personal slights and sort of tries to get his revenge and stuff. It's really, that's the book where he talks about his mum dying and stuff.
Can
and it's hilarious. And it's really short, so it's really easy to read. You can read it in the afternoon. Yeah.
Matt Hall, what's your closing time chatter?
For reasons too long and complicated to go into here, we were discussing. I was discussing with my 9-year-old son the Ken Campbell's 9-hour version of Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminati play, and it transferred. Then I looked up Ken Campbell on the internet to find out what some stuff, more stuff about him. Did you know that he auditioned for the role of Doctor Who?
Of course I did. Obviously.
I think you're in a room with four people who didn't know that.
And also, it was at the Liverpool Everyman, so yeah. Me and Andrew.
And he was turned down, and Sylvester McCoy got the gig, because, according to the showrunner at the time, they didn't call them showrunners, they called them producers back then, his ideas of what to do with the character were just way too dark.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
What would Ken Campbell have been as Doctor Who? In kind of like, you know, and now after the final score finishes, there's a 27-hour episode of Doctor Who. Yeah, it'd just be like
with a naked Prunella G running around in it as well.
But probably. I interviewed him for the Idler magazine.
Oh, wow.
Probably about 15 years ago now. Yeah, so the big Ken Campbell fan.
Yeah,
and I went to see his 24-hour play, The Warp. His production of at the Roundhouse, and left after hour 8.
The original production, of course, featured Janet Fielding, who played Tegan Javanka in Doctor Who.
Yes.
Running around with her kit off. Yeah. Doctor Who connections, they're coming out your ears.
Ken Campbell, I think, was the only play. Well, he produced a play, I think, based on Carol Capek's War of the Newts, where he flooded the Everyman.
Yeah.
He was set on a boat in the middle of the Everyman. Genius.
Well, my closing time chatter is crushingly predictable. Rebellion Comics are reprinting British comics from the 70s. There's been an announcement that they've already done a reprint of the great girls comic Misty, which is fantastic. You know, super kind of like Folly Foot meets Alan Garner world of horror and fantasy for girls. And now they've got a new series of reprints from the less well-loved comics. The first ones are One-Eyed Jack, which is a kind of Dirty Harry Dredger thing for kids, and Faceache by the brilliant Ken Reed. Scrunge, he's changed his face. So they're going to be reprinting not just the cool stuff from Action and so on, but also the odder, weirder stuff from Battle and from, you know, I think, didn't they have Sparky and Wizard and Chips? All the old Fleetway Egmont stuff. They're also going to be reprinting Mike Weston and Eric Bradbury's The Leopard of Lime Street.
Oh,
and you know, best of all,
they're currently not running, I presume.
Well, yeah, The Leopard under a pile of rubble in Lime Street, yes. And brilliantly, Rebellion, because they're a computer games company, they've written special software for the reprographics. They've written their own software to take all this old comics artwork and bring it up to absolutely sparkling representation of our national culture. So that's a good thing. There we go. Another show in the bag. Thanks to our guests, Mark Hooper of Hole and Corner magazine. Mark, what's up next in Hole and Corner?
We're sending the issue to the printers today.
So. Okay, right.
No pressure.
Fair enough, yes.
Still got. Our creative director decided to write a piece and he hasn't finished it yet.
Oh, right. Okay. What's in it?
It's amazing. He went to India. He travelled for about 2 weeks around India and met all these amazing people. So he's interviewed them all, and he's only written up about half of it.
Okay, so you need to get out of the studio now and give him a kick up the behind. Thanks for coming on the show. And also Andrew Mayle of Mojo Guardian and Sight and Sound. What have you got coming up next?
I've got a review, Sam Peckinpah DVD for Sight and Sound, and I've written about the ending of... what am I doing? Oh, and then Future Islands for Mojo which I mentioned earlier. Yeah.
Jolly good. Well, thanks both for coming in, chaps. You're welcome at any time. Remember, dear listener, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again, and in fact, all of our archive shows, at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth, Or you can subscribe. Go to the iTunes Music Store and find the podcast bit down the bottom on the opening page. If you click there and search for us and subscribe, you will not only get the next podcast automatically, you will get it a day early so that you can impress all the cool kids. And of course, we will be delighted if you would give us a star rating, a positive one, please, because it pushes us up the listings a little bit and helps get the word out. So thanks for listening. Matt and I will be back again next week. Until then, have a good one. Bye.